Welcome to the Getting Real with Hillary show, where ordinary heroes tell extraordinary stories during unique and never been heard before conversations with your host, Hillary Arno Burns. Hillary's unique listening and way of asking questions results in conversations that aren't usually talked about, so you can create the life that you really want but are afraid you can't really have. We are demonstrating the greatness in the human spirit and creating a world where we all reclaim our birthright of joy, happiness, purpose, and passion. Now, here's your host, Hillary Arno Burns. Welcome to the Getting Real with Hillary show. And today we have a very special guest, long awaited for interview with the famous Anthony Touton. Anthony has been a theater actor, a producer, a director. He went to film school and has been through some pretty serious stuff. So Anthony is going to talk about before the incident and how he overcame his challenges, and hopefully will inspire all of you. Welcome. Well, we're gonna play a quick film. Before we bring him on, we're gonna play a film clip of him interviewing Kiefer Sunderland. I don't know if I'm saying it right. Kiefer, and we're gonna show that, and then we're gonna start talking to Anthony, and he's gonna tell us everything that went right and everything that went wrong. So welcome, Anthony, in a couple of minutes.
An interview with famed stage and screen actor Kiefer Sutherland. How would you say working on The Red Door has compared to working on films, say, elsewhere in Canada or North America?
It's certainly been unique. I think Newfoundland is such a unique area, such a unique province. Many people refer to it as a country unto itself, and I can understand why.
And with the inconsistencies in the weather that is the norm for St. John's, especially this time of year, has that provided any difficulty in terms of shooting?
It hasn't provided us with any difficulty. I mean, one of the things that you have to kind of remember is, as severe as the weather is here, it's very dramatic. We were out in Portugal Cove, and we were shooting right there on the coast, and within 5 hours, the ice floe came in. If you tried to do that, if you'd written that in a script and you tried to shoot that, it would cost you millions of dollars. Mm-hmm. And we got it for free.
Checking out the local scene, what do you think of George Street?
I don't think I've ever been on a street that had more bars. George Street's fantastic. I mean, we ran into each other last Sunday, and we were just watching a couple bands play, and I remarked that it's been a long time since I watched musicians just hang out and play because they love playing music. And people work very hard here during the week, and the weekend is theirs, and George Street is where they make the most of it.
Rumor has it that you've been screeched in.
Yes. Yeah. I woke up one morning and I had a degree from the Screechers Academy on my desk, and to go downstairs and ask how I got it.
Your grandfather, Thomas Douglas, of course, was renowned and greatly responsible for bringing healthcare to Canada. Mm-hmm. When you travel throughout Canada, do you see the positive effects that that the system has had on this country?
Unfortunately, you've had governments over the years taking money out of the national healthcare system and then telling the people that the healthcare system's not working. Well, of course, if you're not going to fund it, it's not going to work. I've watched the Canadian people actually kind of stand up and say, no, we're not going to accept that anymore. And so I'm very happy, not only from Canada, but from my grandfather's legacy, that Canadian people at least acknowledge how important and what a source of identity the national healthcare system in Canada is to them. And so that's very good.
Well, Kiefer, thanks a lot. It's a pleasure meeting you, and I hope you enjoy the rest of your stay in Newfoundland.
We'll probably see you later on the road.
Cheers. All right. So that was a great film clip of Anthony in his young days interviewing Kiefer Sunderland. I don't know if I'm saying it right. And so welcome. What is it?
Kiefer Sutherland.
Kiefer Sutherland. So welcome.
Why don't we do that whole thing over again? Kiefer Kiefer Sutherland. Right, right. Southern. There you
okay.
go. Okay, we'll try that again.
All right, thank you.
Take two.
All right, so that was a great film clip of the young Anthony interviewing Kiefer Sutherland. And we're gonna backtrack a little when we bring Anthony on. But welcome, Anthony. Can't wait to hear your story. This is Anthony Touton from Canada. So, hi, Anthony, I know. Yes. Hi. Welcome. And, you know, when we were talking, you were talking about your famous family. Can you just talk about, I don't know if the people in the U.S. know about the Toutons of Canada, but can you just tell us a little bit about your growing up and that family and that famous film family?
Yeah, well, actually, incidentally, my great grandfather of the same name, Anthony Touton the First. So his name, he was born Anthony Moses Touton, changed his name to Maurice. He was born in Damascus, Syria, back in 1886. Wow. And he came over to Newfoundland, which was the key port of entry, St. John's, Newfoundland, which is the oldest city in North America and most easterly point. And he structured Touton's photography in 1905 and got the distribution rights from Mr. George Eastman, who founded Kodak out of Rochester, New York, and had a monopoly, my great-grandfather did, up until 1949 when Newfoundland joined Confederation. So Newfoundland is the last province to have joined Confederation and Canada in 1949. And I was born in St. John's, Newfoundland. And my great-grandfather actually, incidentally, was known as Mr. Anonymous in the United States. So he did have quite a bit of clout there. And but things were structured through Newfoundland, out of Rochester, and across Canada up until 49. And then...
you mean in terms of the film?
In terms of the distribution network. So,
was he the only one that could get the film from Kodak where he was and sell it?
Yeah, he was the key distributor. So yeah. It was called wow. Touton's the Kodak Store. And after that, like in the 1950s, late 1940s, early 1950s, Black's photography came on the scene in the rest of Canada. And we had a stronghold on Eastern Canada, Nova Scotia, Newfoundland, Labrador. And we had 600 drop-off points around the island and processed and printed in excess of 100 million rolls of film in Newfoundland alone. So so the business was passed on to my grandfather, who's still alive. He's turning 95 in September. And then on to my father, Anthony Jeffrey Touton, who passed away February 19th, 2019, unfortunately. Mm. So, I grew up in a photographic family, but from a major business standpoint. So the best way of putting it is that my great-grandfather would have been an industrialist in the early 1900s and through both world wars. And we had 5 U.S. bases in Newfoundland. A lot of people in North America are not aware of that right now, but we had 5 U.S. bases throughout both world wars. So it was a major trading point for the troops and tremendous business out of the United States. So, like I said, Newfoundland joined Canada in 1949, but prior to that, we were very, very closely tied with the United States.
So that's an incredible business, right? If you guys were... So anyone who wanted film up until 1949 had to get it through your family, right? Kodak film.
In Canada.
Yeah, in Canada. But that's huge, right?
Yeah,
huge.
It's quite significant. And the culture in Newfoundland is Newfoundland's been historically huge with respect to the fishery. And so we had a cod moratorium several decades ago, and that caused a lot of turmoil for both.
A what moratorium?
A codfish moratorium. So,
codfish.
Yeah. So cod.
Why? Why?
Because the cod was depleting, And so basically, it was we were there was overfishing, so there was a lot of like foreign trawlers and stuff like that coming in, and so it had a huge impact on the people of Newfoundland and industry. And so in the mid-90s, under my father, who was also chairman of the Photo Marketing Association, PMA, head of MPG, youngest president of the Board of Trade, youngest president of Rotary at the same time back in the 80s, he in the mid-90s had to restructure. And so unfortunately, due to industry pressure and the economy in Newfoundland, Tutons had to close its doors in November of 1995. So
Oh.
the reason I say that is because I'll segue to the fact that I was at boarding school. I was sent to Ridley College in the early 90s, and so in 95 I was at Ridley when the business went under, and I had no concept for how that would change my hometown, my home province.
And why did they have to close? Just because there was other people in the business, or what?
No,
Like,
we
what
had
made them close?
it's kind of peculiar. We had 90% plus market share throughout our this is even post monopoly in 1949. We still maintain 90% plus market share. So, and that we were also a distributor of Polaroid, Fuji eventually and all that. It was just the exclusive rights for Kodak ended in 49. And so the thing is that we could have remained, I believe, in business. My father often told me that, but it would have been under a different guise, and it would have been in a completely different capacity. So you had digital photography coming into play, and you had Kodak, whom we were still a chief distributor of. Remember, I said we had 600 drop-off points or dealers. So we were doing all the photography for all the major grocery stores, grocery outlets, drug stores. I mean, you no matter where you were on the island, you could get your film processed and printed, developed through Tutons Photography. So Tutons was everywhere. We had 17 retail outlets, and
So,
they
yeah.
sorry.
So, what happened when you closed? So, people just went to digital. That's why that was what was happening.
Yeah,
People weren't buying film anymore.
it was kind of preemptive,
Wow. Wow.
So there was one,
So, you
maybe,
didn't sell the business, you just closed it,
yeah,
right?
it was closed, it went down, yeah. So there was Tutons Photography, and then there was Tutons Holdings, and the holding company had the properties, and then we had one central plant, which was on Cabot Street, and that was built in 1952. And that was the key plant where they had it structured so that 3,500 rolls of film could be processed and printed a day. And they would come from all the dealers. This is pre, Kodak Color Watch, setups, retailers. So, like I said, we eventually had 17 of those, but it was very,
So,
there was a flagship.
all right. So in 1995, you're at boarding school. The doors are closed. What happens to you? Did you have to stop going to school? Like, did the money stop? Like, what happened? That's a big change, right?
So I went to the University of Toronto at University College on the downtown campus here in Toronto. And I just wanted to say I'm actually speaking with you from Toronto, Ontario right now. And so I did my first year of university there. I had this belief that even though my strengths and my drive was in theater, I had been writing my own stuff at Ridley College and putting it off at the Mandeville Theater, and in drama classes and theater classes with this great teacher, Colin Brzezicki, who was a Rhodes Scholar. And he was my drama teacher, and I was heavily inspired. But I decided that, I had to go the academic route, and That was probably my first in hindsight. I mean, everything happens for a reason, sure, but in hindsight, that would have been my first kind of faux pas where I didn't follow my genuine strengths and instincts. I decided to go to U of T, which is the top university in North America, and I spent my first year there. But there were a set of things that took place. I wasn't able to get student loans because too much money had been earned the year before, and we're not supposed to talk about this type of stuff. And so there was a very, very contentious atmosphere. Whereas for many people going into their first year of university, their sophomore year, they have an opportunity to socialize and interact and get into things that they get into trouble, I guess. But I got into a different type of trouble, and so that created a scenario where then I transferred back home to Newfoundland, to Memorial University of Newfoundland, and that's where I got involved in more theater and I eventually got involved in media, and that's where I interviewed Kiefer Sutherland. Was at a website called sieved.com, SIEVED.com, which was started by Peter Wilkins, who's from Great Britain. And he was using St. John's as a test site. So this is pre-YouTube, pre-Flash Media. We were using QuickTime and doing live streams. And so I was really getting involved in media, but I was also doing a lot of theater. And so I was doing plays like Suburbia, PVT Wars, The Zoo Story, all kinds of stuff. So things were promising, and then the internet bubble burst in the early 2000s there, and so I was kind of left languishing, trying to figure out what to do, and I started doing acting classes here in Toronto with a guy named Kenneth McGregor.
How
And
did the internet bubble affect you?
because I was working at civ.com, and civ
Oh,
was
okay.
so I kind of went from I jumped ahead there. I kind of went from transferring from the University of Toronto, going to Memorial University in Newfoundland, and then having an opportunity with civ, and I became
Okay.
the face of civ.com, and I created their web video section, and that's when I got into media. That was my foray into media through the
Oh,
internet.
cool. All
And
right,
so,
and I have one other question, and I don't know if you want to answer it, but you said you got into trouble at University of Toronto.
I
What
was
kind of?
no, I was being facetious. I was
Oh,
saying
okay.
when people have the opportunity, thanks for clarifying that. When people have the opportunity to have fun and go out and all that, like what for me it was trying. That was my first experience of scrounging to try to figure out how to survive while doing academics. While trying to socialize, because of the fact that I couldn't get student loans, because in
Because of
Canada,
the,
my
yeah.
parents
So the
didn't get.
business had just shut down. So the year before they had plenty of money. Now there's no money. You couldn't get loans because of the year before, right? So all of a sudden you're struggling to survive. You've never had to worry about money before. That's like, right? Am I saying it right? If I'm not, correct me.
Well, it's not that I was from a very conservative family. So my upbringing was very, I would say, magical. But the way that we lived in Newfoundland was different than outside of Newfoundland. And I had spent those formative years at boarding school. And again, like from a very conservative family, no doubt. But I didn't ever expect that I wouldn't be able to get a student loan because too much money had been earned the year before, or anything like
Yeah.
that. So the trajectory, to use that term, of my upbringing was shifted dramatically overnight by the year before in '95,
Yeah.
the year of the business.
Okay. Okay.
And
All right. So
yeah, I
back
was
to Civ. Yeah. So the internet bubble burst.
yeah.
And then what happened? What were you
And
saying?
then what happened was I was this leads up to the incident. The
Right.
incident.
Okay.
I was still doing some, I went back to doing some theater. I was taking some courses at Memorial, kind of languishing, trying to figure out what to do in my early 20s, going from doing an interview with Kiefer Sutherland that what was it, that he didn't grant to anybody else, because we were burgeoning like media. This was like small cameras, digital cameras. Like I was on the foray of that, but I didn't, I think, understand the nature of it. I also didn't understand what was going on socially, even though I was out and about and interviewing people and whatnot. I believe that I was a bit of a target. And then on my father's birthday, December 11th, 2002, I was drugged. Somebody slipped something in my drink and brutally taken advantage of and essentially raped, and to put it bluntly. And it was a horrific incident whereby I came to at, I have been out. Like knocked out, and I came to as it was happening. And I remember specifically thinking, and I know this is heavy, but I remember thinking, I have to remember this. I don't want to remember this. I have to remember this. I remember trying to swing my, like I was into martial arts as well and stuff, and I'm left-handed and my left arm was pinned. I tried to swing my right arm, and that's when I saw the face of the individual. And then was out again and didn't wake up until the early evening, late afternoon the next day, and or that day or whatever. And it was that my life was forever changed. And the
And
aftermath.
where did you wake up? You were still there? You were still at
Yeah.
his place?
Yeah,
Yeah.
wherever that was. And
All right. Okay.
What I mean is that I didn't know where I was. And
Right.
so
Okay.
so it was not like a thriller of a film. If you were to use a genre, it was a horror film. And the aftermath was as horrific, if not more so than before. And what I've learned in saying that to you, what I've learned today is, as hard as it is, not to care about what other people think, not to, and for years I was trying to, I was rehashing the incident. I was rehashing what was going on, and I was drowning my sorrows. And I guess to bring it full circle, and I we discussed this before, you and I had a bit of an epiphany whereby recently I was able to do an interview with a woman named Elizabeth Witten, who's a writer, and she wrote an article which was published April 30th on through the CBC, the Canadian Broadcasting Corporation here in Canada. And that's, I didn't know what to expect, and I knew that my life would be different no matter what. And sure enough, it was dramatically different. And since that point, and since the release of that article, there's been a relief and a sense of, wow, I can talk about this. And it's amazing that by going public, you can actually, I'm going public, whatever that means. I mean, this is public. you can experience, like I said, that sense of relief or a sense of relief, and then it's also empowering. And there's a lot that comes with it. And I feel that by finding my voice, I've been able to get the word out, but at the same time, hopefully help other people. And so that's where we are today.
So, okay, so the incident happened in 2002, right? I know on your dad's birthday. And then the interview with Elizabeth was how many years later?
I mean, I guess 20. It was this past April 30th.
Wow, okay. So 20 years later, and for those 20 years, I know you said you were drowning your sorrows. I guess you weren't talking about it because you were worried about what people would think, right? Is that like, tell me a little bit about those, and if it's too painful, don't. But if
No,
Like 20 years is a long time. So what were you doing for those 20 years? And then we're going to talk about what what where you've been and what you're doing now in the next half. But just if you don't mind, what the heck were you doing for 20 years? Were you working at all? Were you like, where were you living? Like, what was going on?
I was back and forth between Toronto and St. John's, so
Okay.
between the most easterly point and then of in Canada, North America, and then Central Canada, which is here in Toronto, the Mecca of Toronto. And I was trying to find my way. It's not as challenging now thinking back to it, but when I was going through it, it was, like I said, a horror film. It was brutal. So I've never been back on the stage. So I've been acting since I was a kid. Like, I was Jack and Jack and the Beanstalk when I was like when I was young. I was tested by the Guildhall School of Music and Drama. I was taking courses through a woman named Mary Sherrett, and we were regularly putting off plays. I was like, acting was my passion. Nothing came close to that, and it was very natural for me. And so to segue into Civ'd, and learn all the digital media was that component was fantastic. And so, and the work with Peter Wilkins and John Watson and different individuals, it was a great experience.
That
And
was all prior to the incident.
that's prior. And so the reason I say
Right.
that is because I never went back on stage, but what I did do was I would do like a commercial here or there. Like, I was the face of for I Am Canadian, for a Molson Canadian commercial, which was quite significant. There was, some stuff like that. But the reason I say this is I decided to I wanted to go to film school. I wanted to get behind the camera, and I started to do that. And I had been developing the documentary, which ultimately we discussed Tutton's Photography in the Business of Making Memories. I'd been developing that the whole time, no pun intended, and even pre-incident. So, like, I always had this idea to
Okay.
do a documentary about my great grandfather being an immigrant from Damascus, Syria, and having this robust, huge career. And so what happened was I won the entrance scholarship to the Toronto Film School for a piece that I did called Restaurants Are Not Democracies, about Michael Carlovale, who was a famed the late Michael Carlovale, who was a famed chef and restaurateur here in Canada, owned Prego della Piazza, Byzantium, and the Boston Club, and amongst others. And Prego was like the establishment restaurant here at the base of the Renaissance Plaza at Avenue and Bloor Street, next to the
And
Four.
what year was this
That would have
that
been
you?
so I did Restaurants Are Not Democracies. I guess I just released it on online through YouTube, but no, I don't mean just as in recently, but
Yeah.
that was back in like 2000. Six around that time.
Oh,
And
okay. So.
so I got back on track pretty quickly. Like, I was traveling through the US with my ex-girlfriend, developing this documentary, and then I de decided to go to film school, which was at the CBC Center here in downtown Toronto. And so that's when I went into film school, and that's when I really got the passion to start filming associated with the Tutton documentary. So there's a parallel between the Tutton documentary, in and out, in and out, in and out, me dealing with the flashbacks and of the rape and the aftermath, and finding out that it's happened to all these other people, and dealing with the survivor's guilt, which is a whole nother component. And then me being at film school, seeing it through, and then up until well, of course, COVID was horrific,
All
and
right, you know what? We're gonna hold that thought. We're gonna get to COVID, and then we're gonna come back after the commercial break, and then we're gonna keep going and show a bit of your film and finish the rest of the story. Is that cool? You
yeah,
cool with
for sure.
that? Okay. All right. Very good.
Has social emotional learning become just one more thing on your teachers' plates? Do teachers and students both find it boring and ineffective? Then bring Kikori to your school. Kikori transforms classrooms through experiential SEL activities that help students play, reflect, connect, and grow. Even better, students say it's more fun than recess. Schedule a no-obligation conversation at kikoriapp.com/bringkikori. KIKORI.
Do you ever feel like you can't say what you really want to say? Or that you're stuck or in a holding pattern in your relationships, career, personal life, or finances? Are there things you want in life that you've given up on? Are you resigned that this is as good as it's going to get? If you answered yes to any of these questions, then Hillary Burns, host of the Getting Real with Hillary Show, has the solution you need. Hillary is a published author of 3 books and has a program called the Getting Real Process. This process frees you from what is holding you back, allowing you to create a life you love. Don't believe it? It is hard to believe that it could work, isn't it? The proof is that hundreds of Hillary's clients have used the Getting Real Process and are now free to create whatever they want in relationships, career, finances, enjoying life, or just loving themselves more. So go to realtalkwithhillary.com and order Hillary's book, Real Talk, and set up a conversation.
All right, so thank you to our sponsor, Kikori App. That's where my daughter Haley works, and it's a wonderful company. Social emotional learning for children. If you have any kids who you think are behind or just want to bring in social emotional learning that's fun, go to kikori.app. Normally, I would show my books, my Real Talk book. You could go to realtalkwithhillary.com. If you don't think you speak up, if you're afraid to speak up, we can work together. That's been what I've been overcoming for years, is not speaking up, people pleasing, being pleasant, and not being my real self. So if that's something that calls to you, connect with me at realtalkwithhillary.com. Get my book and let's get you free. So anyway, welcome back, Anthony Tuton. What an incredible, incredible story. Thank you so much for your generosity, for being willing, for your courage. And I just want to say that, you know, when we had been talking before, I know there had been a 20 year gap between the incident and now and you speaking up. So I'm glad to hear that you weren't just drowning your sorrows that whole time, and that, you know, that's when you went to film school. That's when you were touring the States with your girlfriend and working on your documentary, which we're going to see a little bit of. So what else were you doing during that time? And then what had you finally talk to Elizabeth? Or is that too much to remember?
No, it's not. It's crazy because there's a book called In the Blink of an Eye by Walter Murch, who's probably considered one of the greatest cinematic film editors of all time. And yeah, he wrote this book called In the Blink of an Eye, and I was just thinking that title, which is almost like a cliche, but cliches are cliches because they're true. And that title, in the Blink of an Eye, is how I kind of see that 20 years. It's almost like overnight everything changed, and whether there was some brain damage due to the drugging and or the actual attack, it was like an out-of-body experience. So I almost felt like a bit of an alien, and I would have to suddenly, people expected me to be normal. People expected me to be, you know, there's all this talk like, are you gay and all this sort of stuff. It doesn't matter if you're gay or straight. I am straight. But the thing is, it doesn't matter. Rape is rape. It's like Obama made that statement, you know, when Senator Todd Akin made those horrible statements with respect to rape, and President Obama came out and said, look, rape is rape. You know, you can parse this word, you can parse that word, it doesn't matter. And so I learned to live according to that. But in terms of the last 20 years, it was like it took place in the blink of an eye. And then when I think back, I'm like, well, at least I have some relief now. But what led up to the pre-interviews with Elizabeth and then the discussions with her and up to the article and not knowing what was going to transpire once the article was released. Like, it was delayed by a week. That week was like more harrowing than probably anything else, because it, you know, it's in your head and you're trying to extrapolate these ideas and visions and stuff like that. And then you don't know what to expect.
Anthony, when you said, like you felt like an alien, people were expecting you to be normal. So, you know, there you are pretending to be normal and inside your head is not normal. Like, you're going crazy inside your head. So you felt like two people, sort of. Would you, is that correct or no?
Yes.
Over 20 years, you're living pretending to be okay. But meanwhile, that's what's circling insert, right? Is that?
Yeah. Yeah. And, wow. And all the symptoms. So I have ADHD and I was diagnosed with post-traumatic stress disorder due to this incident very shortly thereafter, but I wasn't aware of that. And this was done in Newfoundland. And so I'm back and forth between Newfoundland and Ontario. And the thing is, in Canada, healthcare is structured provincially. So the two different provinces don't necessarily communicate with one another. And then the onus is on the individual to properly communicate what's going on. So, for example, the way that I'm presenting myself right now is not an act. This is like very much how I am and who I am. The way that I presented myself during that period of time prior to the release of this article is dramatically different. Now, it should be noted, there are some very, 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 very key people that want to remain nameless, but that helped. So they just, through the kindness of their hearts, and actually that's why I'm able to speak to you today, is because I was guided by a set of individuals who stepped in. And so they stepped in prior to the article, and it is rather recent. So I was targeted several times.
Stepped in how? Like medically or emotionally or every way? How did they step in?
In hindsight, like there was it was a multi-layered effort. But that's only in hindsight. As it was happening, I was just following my instincts. Again, you don't know who to trust, right? Because I trusted those people that night on my dad's birthday, you know, back in 2002. I mean, it's like, you know, the great singer and performer Eddie Vedder from Pearl Jam said, you know, success is the greatest revenge, because and this is a form of success, being able to find your voice, being able to communicate with people like yourself and interact with people like Don and Doug Newsom and have a sense of, okay, well, it's like mise en place, right? And time and place. And that's where I am right now, where I was able to find my voice by accepting the support of people I could suddenly trust. And in trusting them, I, you know, found myself to you, and I, and here we are. Like, this is all. And so we could say that there was in hindsight, the since my film was released and won the award in San Diego back in late September of 2021, Teutons Photography in the Business of Making Memories, that the trajectory, even though there were several horrific things that happened and I got targeted and everything stolen and hacked, I was able to find my voice and find my way out of that. And that led me to being able to entrust the right people. But there's something very challenging with PTSD, the trust factor. So it's very, very difficult to know who to trust and when to trust them. But when you finally do and you realize that they've got your back and they're going to stand by you, it's better than winning the lottery, right? Like in terms of the cliched concept, it's that we think of in society and cultures, right? Like it's akin to relearning who you actually are and understanding that there are great people out there. And so that corollary, that sense of relief and goodness, and
it, love, would you love, say love?
Yeah, love. It overrides that 20 years of debauchery and horrific flashbacks. One thing I wanted to tell you is with PTSD, what was most brutal was I could never sleep properly. So like I was constantly acting like I was okay or trying to when I wasn't. And that's what was taking place. So like I would have these flashbacks that would immediately your instinct is almost like a suicidal one, whereby you're thinking, I just want this to end. I need this to end, you know, but the stress is so overwhelming. And then the hardest part is seeing how it impacts other people and then being left kind of silent and wordless at times, because you're faced with the guilt, not just the survivor's guilt, that, oh, like all these other people were hurt after I was hurt, in terms of the timing. So therefore, you know, why couldn't I have done something about it? Or I should have done this differently. Or if the police had gotten involved, but like, maybe if this had happened differently, you know, like the thing is, I adamantly told the truth, and they say the truth will set you free, but maybe it takes over 20 years for that to happen. Right? So
maybe. Wow. So, all right. So how did, yeah. So I'm sorry about all that. It sounds horrific, as you said. How did you get connected with Elizabeth, and how did you, I mean, if you were, you said you were talking about it during that time, but I think you were talking about it in a different way than when you talked to Elizabeth on April 30th, because that somehow got you free, the way you talked to Elizabeth. What is the difference between how you were talking about it and how I know I'm asking you like five questions.
No, it's okay. With respect to Elizabeth, I had come across some of her work. This is all online. This is the magic of where we're at with Facebook and different apps and stuff. I had come across some of her work. I knew that she had studied in Germany, and she was from Newfoundland, and she was a young freelancer, and we had connected, and then I communicated to her that, look, I think I have a story here, you know? And I should go back. I'd done a video with Angèle Lessard, who's from North Bay here in Ontario. And that's for her organization called the Family Village Services. And it was for Mental mm-hmm. Health Week. And that was a couple of years back. And so it was kind of on the heels of that. I'd come back to realize, okay, look, I've won this award, or I've gotten this recognition through San Diego, of all places, for a documentary out of Newfoundland. But there's more to this story. Like, it's not just like, oh, like you made this film, you know. It was like it was a labor of love. But the thing is that there was more going on. So then when I connected with Elizabeth after having seen some of her work, I just kind of tossed around the idea with her. And then that was like in March of, you know, prior to April. And then we did a pre-interview while I was living with my friend Johnny Sikkema, who owns a company called Buzzbox. And I was working with him. And then I did the like kind of pre-interview with her from Johnny's and from his office. And then I kind of felt this like strange relief because I was in survival mode. This is just, you know, recently in the spring. And then it was my friend, Marianne, who really, I guess, caught on to the fact that I was improving as I was speaking about this. And then I did the real pre-interview with Elizabeth. And then that's when I thought, it was over the phone, and I got off the phone and I thought, okay, this is uncharted territory. I've never really felt this way before. What the heck's going to happen? And then it was just like back and forth. You know, is this going to get picked up? Like, what's going, like, it was more like, I kind of just let it go. I said, okay, it's out there. I've said my piece. And then, like I said, the article was supposed to come out. And then I felt very, 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 very nervous. And I knew that my life was going to be different. I don't mean to overdramatize it. It's literally what I felt. And I knew it was going to be different the day after it came out. And then it finally came out April 30th. And I was with my friend. And I read it. I kind of was wondering if I should take like a Johnny Depp approach, which is he doesn't watch his own stuff, you know, like it's kind of like set it and forget it, move on. Right. But I read it and I thought, wow, this is pretty powerful. And I thought she did a remarkable job of encapsulating what I spoke to her about. And then I thought, okay, this is going to be interesting. And then I realized that it kind of went gangbusters and it went out like in a very specific way over the internet, because it was an actual article that was like written for the internet, you know, published through the Crown Corporation of the Canadian Broadcasting Corporation. So it was pretty major. And they used pictures of me from before with a character that I created named Buckheimer Styles. And like they juxtaposed that against an image of me presenting my film at the Niagara Artists Center. So it was kind of like this thing that was beyond me. And the story came through, and I liked the fact that they just addressed, or she addressed it with a couple of lines, you know, in terms of sexual assault and, but what that represents. And I think anybody that understands, you know, that how horrific something like that can be, because we're not just, I don't mean to downplay any aspect of it or overplay any aspect of it. It is what it is. We're talking about, like I said, it was like an out of body experience. It has nothing to do with whether or not you're straight or gay. It has more to do with this date rape drug, which, thank God, has since the early 2000s been marginalized and taken off the streets, because frankly, the people who were putting it out there were having it happen to themselves and to their kids and to their nieces and nephews, and they were realizing the impact of it. And so we're talking about, you know, thousands and thousands of people that were impacted that have not found a voice.
Well, thank you for speaking up for all of you.
Thank you for giving me an opportunity to do so.
So how, you know, we were talking about when you finally can speak. And again, the difference between you speaking in that interview versus those 20 years speaking about it. What was the difference that day or during those pre-interviews with Elizabeth? Were you finally able to kind of marry the pretend self to the real self and become whole again, do you think? It almost sounds like that alien sort of disappeared as you spoke to her and you could come back to yourself and stop hiding in a sense, versus when you told the story before, I don't know.
Yeah. So
what do you think the difference was? Yeah.
suddenly I haven't drank in a long time. I was drowning my sorrows in alcohol for years and years and years. And alcohol has its benefits. Obviously, it was prescribed at different points for post-traumatic stress disorder during Prohibition and different times. And
during Prohibition.
No, it's true. It's true.
Wow.
And during both world wars, actually, Sir Frederick Banting, who's the founder of insulin, and I did a documentary about him. It was being like he would prescribe it for individuals with shell shock, as it was called,
wow.
which is now known as post-traumatic stress disorder as well. But the thing is that.
So what happened? Yeah. Go back to that interview.
Yeah. So what happened was it was on instinct. Actually, I was inspired by an interview that a friend of mine who hosts a show called Q here in Canada, a very famous show, Tom Power, and he interviewed Bono from U2. And they talked about the church and they talked about religion. And Tom Power spoke up about Mount Cashel. And Mount Cashel was the orphanage in Newfoundland, which was is historically known. It was torn down, but there was major sexual assault that took place at the hands of the Christian Brothers in Newfoundland. And so just quickly, Tom, you know, asked Bono about religion, and then Bono, his response to what Tom said when he asked Tom Power what he had thought, and he used the example of growing up in Newfoundland like myself and hearing about these egregious acts that happened through the Mount Cashel orphanage at the hands of the Christian Brothers. And then Bono's response was the coolest, calmest, most appropriate response I think I've ever seen. And that's what inspired me. That's when I said, I have to do something about this. Then there was also some other music.
What was his response?
Just very calculated and very calm. Like he knew, like he understood better than anybody coming from Ireland. And like Newfoundland's like a sister to Ireland, right? So like my middle name is McGraw. I'm heavily Irish as well. So it's like, so the thing is that.
So he inspired you with however he was calm. And then you went to the interview and you somehow took that on.
I just spoke the truth and I just let it flow. And
wow.
I didn't know what, like there was no rhyme or reason except to say, I'm going to speak the truth. I'm going to find my voice through speaking the truth, which I feel I'm kind of doing now. Obviously I'm prone to taking tangents in this state, but it's, I come upon it, I think honestly, not to frustrate, but sometimes it's good to frustrate because you want to shake shit up. You know, you want to shake things, sorry for my language, but you want to shake things up and you want to find the real you, you know, and inspire other people. And so when you find that voice and you find that strength, it there's something very cathartic about it. And we're always in repair, right? We're constantly in repair. Like that which I came up with a statement through all of this, that which is easy for you is not easy for everybody else.
Mm-hmm.
So it might be very easy for you to have a show and to present yourself in a certain way and find people that inspire you to constantly create a better show. In my case, for years I was relegated to a certain position which was very kind of barbaric, like I, you know, Neanderthalic. Like I couldn't even. That's why I couldn't act, because I wasn't myself. You know. And so I'd find substances to try to cope and fill the voids. And the thing is that, by finding my voice, it was very cathartic. And so in hindsight, I didn't know this going into it, Hillary, but right. in hindsight, up until that, the release of that article, the therapeutic nature and the therapy that took place there is like nothing I've ever experienced. And maybe, you know, wow, I mean, 20 years, I mean, now I can just hope that the next 20 are the very best and only greater because of what I experienced. So like there is no good or bad, there just is type thing.
Right. So it sounds like, yeah, I mean, I think we all go through, you know, I had a period where I wasn't myself. I wrote my first book about it. I didn't know how it had happened, but I woke up one day and said, who the heck am I? And it mm-hmm. and it was a process to come back. So I get it. And I didn't have a horrific, I mean, I'm not comparing it. I didn't have a horrific incident. I had my own, you know, I had my own stuff. But I think we all maybe lose track of ourselves. And then, you know, the good news is you're coming back or you're back. So welcome back to the world. Yeah. And thank you so much. Let's see, how much time do we have? Okay, we have just enough time. Thank you so much, really, for your courageousness and your authenticity. We're going to show a little bit of your documentary right now that won the award in San Diego. I can't find my notes, but I'm sure you can tell us. And then in case we go right to the end, what is there any message you have for people, anyone who's maybe gone through something like this or anything that you just want to say? Before we go to your documentary.
Yes, that you are enough. You have it within you to be enough and to tackle whatever comes in front of you. That unfortunately, some people don't make it. Some people, and that's it's for them that, you know, we pray and we say, okay, well, that person couldn't make it. I remember there was nothing cathartic about seeing somebody who had the same thing happen to them, apparently at the hands of the same perpetrator and predator. There was nothing cathartic about seeing them worse off than I was. I almost wanted to feel their pain more myself than they did, but there is a way out and you can pull yourself out of that paper bag. You don't have to act your way out of it. You can just be true and real, find your voice, and there is a way out and you are enough.
Thank you. Well, thank you for finding your voice.
Thank you for giving me an opportunity to do so.
Yeah. And if people want to find you, where did I write it? We have, if you want to go to, well, his old YouTube with the Kiefer Sutherland is youtube.com/Touton, T-O-O-T-O-N. And his newer YouTube is YouTube at Toutons, T-O-O-T-O-N-S, Photography in the Biz, B-I-Z. Is there any other way that people could contact you if they have a story or they want to make a documentary or anything or get in touch? How would they do that?
Yeah, they can email me at TootonAnthony@gmail.com. So TOOTONANTHONY@gmail.com.
All right. Awesome. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
A family business is a passion play because you're mixing blood and money.
Two times a coat.
If you're taking pictures at all, the only one place to go is Tulips. So it was sort of a monopoly stage in the early years. Yeah.
Two times a coat extra will make your prints in any style you want, gloss, semi-gloss, or matte finish. The frequent expressions of pleasure from our many satisfied customers are best testimonials to the quality of our work.
Wow. So what would Poppy be saying to Joey here?
Harry, Harry, thank you, friends, for your loyal patronage in the past year. And we wish you all a very happy new year, Tutankhamun's the Kodak store.
He was just, at that time, as was my father, a very successful businessman who had built a business. And this generally happens with immigrants that come over. They put everything into their particular thing, not only throughout St. John, but probably known throughout the country. Kodak was the big name, and Tutankhamun's was Kodak.
Right.
Tony, Jeff Sterling, we didn't have a 50-year contract. And we had, in fact, we had nothing but a word of mouth. And he was on with us during the entire time he ran the business.
In the business of making memories, both of you, three of us, take, what's the date? 15th of January, 2010. Take one.
So thank you for watching the Getting Real with Hillary show today with Anthony Tutankhamun. It has certainly been courageous of him to tell his story. And I hope that this show can make a difference for other people who may have experienced something traumatic like him. And again, if you find yourself not finding your voice, you can reach out to Anthony at TutankhamunAnthony@gmail.com or go to realtalkwithhillary.com, take the Real Talk quiz, and I am happy to help anybody who is afraid to speak up, you know, just can't see themselves speaking up. That was me, that was Anthony, and I'm happy to get all of us free. So thank you again for listening. It's been real.
Thank you for listening to the Getting Real with Hillary show. We hope you are entertained and inspired. Please subscribe to Hillary's newsletter. Go to gettingrealwithhillary.com for more freedom techniques and fantastic stories and links to other great stuff. And don't forget to tune in every week on Tuesdays at 1 p.m. Eastern Time on BBS Radio TV. And let's get real. Let's get connected. Let's get inspired and create that life you love.